Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Tuesday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column and podcast episode several years ago. More than two, less than ten. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on November 30th of 2014 under the headline, "The Father of Oregon's Nursery Industry and His Free Love Cult." Here we go. You may have heard of Henderson Llewelling, the Quaker nurseryman who founded an Oregon industry when he brought a wagon full of tiny trees out on the Oregon Trail back in 1847. His story was recently memorialized in a children's book that won the Oregon Reads Award for the state's sesquicentennial celebration back in 2009, Apples to Oregon by Deborah Hopkins. On the trail to Oregon, many of Llewelling's fellow emigrants thought he was crazy. The care he lavished on these trees, even at the expense of his wife and nine children, was by anyone's lights obsessive. But history vindicated Llewelling when the few hundred surviving tree slips made him a wealthy man upon his arrival in the Willamette Valley. But those comrades of the trail who suspected his sanity were probably not entirely wrong, a point that would be confirmed a dozen years later, just before the Civil War, when Llewelling led another little group of pilgrims into the wilderness with a completely different goal in mind: free love. Now, you may think free love meant something different in 1860 than it means today. And indeed, the term today conjures visions of swingers and swappers and dreadful paperback books with titles like The Lust Lords and Sisters in Sin. Well, that much at least is new. But the core concept of free love was the same then as it is today. The free love thing is far from new. Over the years, especially in the American West, at least a half a dozen generations have produced at least one quote-unquote daring philosopher who calls for a throwing off of the age-old yoke of marriage and family and urges his or her followers to revert to the mythic, noble, savage life of naked and unashamed people gathering freely and openly, men and women living and eating and sleeping together with no rules, no judgment, and no squabbles over paternity. Such appears to have been the vision that came to Henderson Llewelling around the age of 55. By this time, he had moved to California, leaving his brother Seth with the Oregon nursery that he'd founded in Milwaukee. In the Golden State, he started a prosperous fruit farm, which was worth plenty of money. He'd also started his very own free love cult, the Harmonial Brotherhood. Llewelling's group made free love the centerpiece of a strict regimen of self-denial that included an all-vegetarian, stimulant-free diet, cold water hydropathy for any medical need, and a utopian all-property-in-common social structure. The Brotherhood had grown and gained adherents, but there were problems for Llewelling's happy band. The biggest of these was the inconvenient fact that California society just wasn't hospitable to their vision of the world. Llewelling decided he needed to lead his flock into a wilderness somewhere, where they might create a whole new society, a society founded on their own principles. In such a place, the Brotherhood could demonstrate the soundness of its philosophy without interference and judgment from a prim, preachy, overdressed mainstream society. So Llewelling sold his beautiful farm and, taking all the money, invested it in a schooner, the Santiago. Its destination? Honduras. Realizing belatedly what he was up to, Llewelling's wife rushed to court to swear out a writ de lunatico inquirendo. What the old man had in mind would leave her and their children, all but the two boys who were going to go with him, homeless, penniless, and dependent on charity. The courts were very sympathetic, and soon there were cops out looking for Llewelling. He quickly went into hiding, waiting until the schooner had sailed out to the Golden Gate before stealthily paddling out into the bay under cover of darkness to join his fellow travelers aboard ship. Those fellow travelers, according to an article from the San Francisco Times, were quite a group. Llewelling wasn't the only one of them who had to board the ship by stealth and by night. One fellow passenger had skipped on some bills and was running from the law. Another couple was delayed trying, unsuccessfully, to force their teenage daughter to come on the trip. Still others just didn't want to undertake the walk of shame up the gangplank of the Santiago in broad daylight. After all, what would the neighbors think? Once on board, the free lovers immediately got busy creating great merriment for the professional crew of sailors aboard the schooner, who, upon their return, became the love cult's rather merciless biographers with the help of the reporter from the San Francisco Times. The journey appears to have been dogged with several major issues. The first was a question of leadership. Llewellyn was the group's leader, but another fellow, referred to in the newspapers as Dr. T, a one-time circus performer who was now a preacher and spiritualist, hence the doctor title with which he favored himself, thought that he himself ought to be the alpha, and lost no time in initiating a remarkably unbrotherly and unharmonious feud with Llewellyn over who got to be top banana. The second issue, and the one that generated the most drama aboard ship among these ostensible vegetarians, was a quest for meat. The power of belief is a force that can move mountains, but many of those mountains are imaginary, and when that power fetches up against a more grounded force, things can get interesting. In this case, the cult members' firm belief in the goodness and healthfulness of their harmonious diet, as they called it, was now slowly being ground down by the animal cravings of their starving bodies, which they were trying to force to subsist on coarse ground whole wheat flour and little else. Consequently, there was, according to the article, quote, "much secret eating of salt pork and drinking of coffee and tea, which were also forbidden." And when that sort of dietary cheating was discovered, there were accusations and recriminations, liberally salted with that particular viciousness that springs from secret envy. The ship made landfall in Zihuatanejo a few weeks later, and passengers hurried ashore to bathe in a stream. This they did in fine, noble, savage style, stripping and plunging in buck naked, the ladies moving about 50 yards upstream from the gents. Unfortunately, this Edenic party was interrupted at its upstream end by a group of local men who immediately rose to the occasion, rushing to disrobe and join the skinny-dipping damsels frolicking in the water. A cry of alarm from one of the ladies brought one of the Harmonial Brotherhood men rushing up, and he drove the local interlopers off. And that might have brought an end to it had not Dr. T then belatedly arrived on the scene, apparently forgetting that he was supposed to be rejecting such bourgeois hang-ups. Dr. T took offense at the rescuers having seen his wife naked and threatened to, quote, "break every bone in his body in defense of her honor and virtue." Presumably it was okay for Dr. T to see the other ladies naked, though. Alpha male privilege, perhaps. Well, it wasn't a great start, and it would not get better. We'll talk about the rest of the Santiago's ill-fated journey, the scramble for meat, the scuffle over several dozen eggs that ripened into civil strife and nearly into bloodshed, the awful demonstration of the ineffectiveness of cold water therapy as a cure for tropical fever, and the shame-faced return of the cult members to San Francisco in next week's column. Key sources in this story have included works by Heather Arndt Anderson, Sarah B. Wren, and of course, an article from the Sacramento Daily Union. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. More information is at our hub page, offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulplit Productions, a boutique publishing house about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. Speaking of which, if you enjoy listening to me, you might check out my other podcast, the weekly Friedrich Wilhelm von Jungst Library of Forgotten Worlds podcast. It's basically readings of classic pulp stories. You can find it with a search for von Jungst, V-O-N space J-U-N-Z-T, on iTunes or on your podcatcher. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Want to visit about Oregon history or anything else? Email me for any reason or for no reason at all at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday morning, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.